two, question form it ends, and now another question. So these are penetrating things that come into the lives of Christians to test them, whether you really love the Lord your God and so forth. And some of the things you can't understand, and you're not meant to understand right away, but you will eventually. Eventually, they are and are. And sometimes you find that after 20, 30, 40 years in the truth, that certain things that were problematical with you are explained later. You see, but by faith, you accept it as such as being superior information to your own brain capability of grasping. And Peter, it's marvelous, isn't it? To whom shall we go?
This is simple.
Yeah. With hope, such high hope, and now to forsake. He's learned too much. Even this he can't understand, but to whom shall we go?
And
we believe and are sure you are the Christ. We're sure of that, no matter what.
Yes, on one occasion, in another gospel, he says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the... Whom do other men say? And then Jesus says, who do you say? Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Blessed art thou, Peter. Flesh and blood hath not revealed that to thee, but my Father which is in heaven. So you can see Peter, I believe, is one of the leading three, without question, of these apostles. Paul, Peter, and John. Any other questions before we conclude the study?
Just that if all the instances are added up, and maybe some aren't even recorded, Jesus certainly gave enough hints about one of the 12 not having the right heart condition. And you wonder if it pursued this at all, at least initially, or at what point did he become so hardened that there was no chance of these people? It might have been until the end if there was absolutely no chance.
I'm surprised if they didn't begin to get wonder which one of us is the devil, you know.
Yeah. And that's strong language. Mm-hmm. It says one of you is the devil. Yes?
Is this to be taken that Christ had chosen the 12 apostles and not his Father?
No. Well, the apostles, the Father draws all the disciples. Not the Father, apostle. We're talking about just the believer. The Father draws the drawing. But of those that were drawn, these 12, in following them, when he went to them individually, there were miraculous things that happened with them, recorded earlier in John about Philip, Nathanael, John himself as one of the disciples with John the Baptist, so forth, they had special dealings in the beginning, and Jesus would know who they were. Based on the Father's will. But then when he went up into the mountain, he gave them the names, each of them their names. But he prayed about it before this whole experience, and then called them one by one to come to him, where he had a personal conversation, and he gave them a new name. Simon, his name was changed to Peter, so forth. And, so in that way, they became his apostles, apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ, sent out one. So he sent them out, but their selection, that's another matter. So they're called apostles, which means one sent out. He appointed them, but actually, they were previously selected of God for the purpose that they were.
There is a scripture to that. I don't know where. Of those that thou hast given me, only one.
So it could speak one way in a qualified sense, and it could speak in another way in the direct sense, in that he sent them out in a formal way. Let us then close this particular study. Verses 1 through 9, Sister Catherine.
After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of the tabernacle was at hand. His brethren therefore said unto him, Depart hence, and go into Judea, that thy disciples also may see the works that thou doest. For there is no man that doeth anything in secret, and he himself seeketh to be known openly. If thou do these things, show thyself to the world. For neither did his brethren believe him in him. Then Jesus said unto them, My time is not yet come, but your time is alway ready. The world cannot hate you, but me it hateth, because I testify of it, that the works thereof are evil. Go ye up unto this feast. I go not up yet unto this feast, for my time is not yet full come. When he had said these words unto them, he abode still in Galilee.
Now, when we go back to verse 1, you'll notice that verse 1 is like a preposition or a preface to the next situation, starting with verse 2. And it says, After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. After what things?
Right.
When we studied chapter 6, what did we find there?
He spoke about the bread. He's the living bread from heaven.
All right, there was illustration of the feeding of the multitudes, and then later when he crossed to the other side, he explained some of the things that he didn't explain when he actually fed the multitudes, that the bread that was back in Moses' day, this is like what we call a spin-off from previous remarks, the incident of when he fed the multitude. When he crossed the sea to Capernaum, went in the synagogue and so forth, there was certain discussions and the explanation of the bread. But what happened between when he ended these things? Notice verse 59 in chapter 6. These things said he in the synagogue as he taught in Capernaum. And then it mentions another incident where even his own personal disciples were stumbled momentarily, with his remarks about eating, except you eat my flesh and drink my blood. There's no life in you, as it were. That was a hard thing. But now what happened after that?
The apostles, if they would leave them too.
But there's something that happened that is not, there's no explanation, there's no expression, there's an omission here. What happened during this omission? Between the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. What happened that we know happened, but it's not a word here. Except.
He must have moved.
All right, where did he move to?
To Galilee. From Capernaum.
No, he says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. But where was he before he walked in Galilee? Because he was in Galilee when he fed the multitudes, when he explained what the bread represented, when he said, some of his own disciples left.
Well, it was the time of Passover.
Uh-huh. because it did say that the feast of the Passover was at hand. Then it tells about the feeding of the multitude, the crossing of the sea, his going into the synagogue, but then the next thing, he went to that Passover, which it doesn't say. He went to the Passover, and it doesn't say. But we know he went because it says all males under the law had to go to three feasts, and one of those three feasts was the Feast of Passover. So he went down to that Passover and then returned home. And that was a little trip of which it's void here. Yes?
So there's a 6 month gap between the end of chapter 6 and verse 2 of chapter 6.
That's right. That's what it is. There's a 6 month gap of which there's nothing written there. So he returns to Galilee. So this is the setting, and then it says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, because he had to go down to Judea in order to attend that feast, and then he didn't linger down there at any length of time. He went back to Galilee, and which we'll find some more. And then, now he's back in Galilee, and it mentions that even when he was down there at the Passover, that the Jews wanted to kill him there, certain ones of them. Notice, because the Jews sought to kill him. That is, when he was down in Judea. So he didn't linger down there, came right back, before they could make plans to try to capture him, and so forth, which, of course, they couldn't do, but there's a divine economy here. No use of making unnecessary problems until they become necessary. Now he's back in Galilee, and now comes another feast is coming now along. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. When was the Feast of Tabernacles?
15th day of the seventh month.
All right. When was the Passover?
The first month, 14th.
All right. So the first month is 14 days. If you start from there, the second month is 1, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th month. It's 6 months exactly, within a day or two. And we find that it picks up the thread of his ministry at this point in time. Now, this is coming, he is going to go down there again, but not ostensibly. He's quiescent on a certain matter here.
Okay.
Yes?
What the Nisan is equivalent to the Passover, isn't it?
Yes. That's the slaying of the lamb, and the feast is the 15th day. The Feast of Passover is the 15th day, and the Feast of Tabernacles is also the 15th day. 6 months later. But it says that now the Feast of Tabernacles, it mentions here, was at hand, it's supposed. Now, he's up in Galilee, so now he has to go down there. He has to go down there. So this would be, say, 4 days before or so that feast. So this is the introduction. Now, what happens? His brethren, verse 3, said unto him, Depart hence from where?
Galilee.
From Galilee. And go into Judea, that thy disciples also may see the works that thou doest. All right. What works had he been doing?
Disease.
No, he was doing, Jesus was not inactive in those 6 months. He was not inactive. He was doing things in Galilee. In Galilee. But of course, his brethren now, they said, why do you do it up here? What's Galilee? Go down to the capital. Go down to, right to the center of the, if you want to be known, why do all these marvelous things up here? just go down there and do what you're doing up here, down there, and you'll prosper. They couldn't understand the logic of why he seemed to limit himself to this particular area. That's one aspect. There's a couple others. Yes?
There was a comment in one of the reprints, sort of a paraphrase thought at the end of verse 4, which I thought was plain good. If you're claiming to give eternal life to others, don't act as if you're afraid to lose yours. Go ahead down and choose them. Don't be afraid.
Yeah. That was another thing, which we'd like to enlarge more on later in more detail. Now, who are these brethren?
His own relatives. Two of them were apostles, James and Alphaeus and Jude.
But those are not the ones.
So it would be the others. Is it Joseph and Simon?
There were four. Yeah, Simon and Joseph.
Joseph is Joseph?
Yes, it could be, yes. But it's not listed as Joseph. So when you go back to Matthew, there are two places where it enumerates the four. But of those four, two were apostles. And two were his brethren, but not apostles. And it's those two that could not understand why he did certain things. And verse 4 is, of course, a continuation of 3, because they did not only say, depart from here, Galilee, and go down to Judea, and do your works down there, but there's no man that doeth anything in secret, because Galilee was considered off limits to a certain extent. Galilee was like the summer resort of the Romans, the Roman army, who made their capital up there in the northern region, Tiberias, which is on the Sea of Galilee, and there are beautiful springs there, mineral baths. We never took advantage of them when we were up there because we had a very short time. We did this in the Dead Sea and other places. But up there, there's too much to see in Galilee to do those. But those mineral baths up there were very well known by the Romans, and they occupied most of the southern half of the lake. But the northern half of the lake was Jewish settlement. Not large, but mostly Jewish. So when they say, don't do it in secret, that means that this is like, was not many, from religious reasons, who did not want to be ceremoniously contaminated by going up in that area where there were so many foreigners. It mentions that this area was sometimes called what? Galilee
of the Gentiles.
Of the Gentiles. Meaning that there were a lot of the Gentiles up there at this summer resort, 800 feet below sea level in the wintertime, very nice. You can go swimming and all, and it's like a year-round resort. Of course, this is not written in the Gospel. But we know from history that, and why it's called the Galilee of Gentiles. Because that's where they predominated their influence. And but they, instead of say, why do it so, they say it in a little, what kind of manner? These brethren are talking to Jesus in a what type of tone? Yeah. Taunting, derogative, or a little sarcasm. Because when they say secret, that's exaggerating the situation. Because there were a number of Jews up there, but relatively speaking, yes, it was. If you were a politician, or you wanted to be king, you certainly wouldn't want to waste your efforts up there in a relatively unimportant. Has any prophet ever arisen out of Galilee? No, up there you wouldn't. You wanted to go down into Jerusalem area, get notoriety. But by saying secret, they're exaggerating. So that's quite a dig. And I think Jesus felt that, because we'll try to demonstrate. That went in on him. He was very courageous, Jesus. Extremely courageous. But also used his reasoning. He never deliberately exposed himself to danger unless he knew it was God's will. He felt a responsibility. He was a responsible character, and he avoided trouble except when he saw this was meant to be. This is God's will for him. So to get this, if you're a very courageous person, having no fear, except the doing of God's will, not to do something contrary, and somebody gives slants a little dig like that to you, it hurts. It hurts. They're impugning his character. And then using this nice, logical way, and many other people listening to them, yeah, why doesn't he go down there? You know, many people are influenced by these suggestions. And so it would not only hurt Jesus personally, he would know it would affect other people, that reasoning. And he had to curb his feelings. And notice how he does it. If thou do these things, shew thyself to the world. Now notice, for neither did his brethren believe in him.
This would be the verse that clarifies the brethren verse 2, right? Because verse 3 alone, it could be any brethren.
It could be, yes, this is in the family. This is close, very close. That's another subject, which we have spoken on in the past, but not today. Yes.
But if he said at that point in time, their eyes were holden later
yes.
on.
And these two were with the mother quite a bit, because even when his mother and his brethren were without the circle when he was giving a sermon at one time, they desired to see him. Then he turned to the disciples, who is my father, mother? Who is my brother and sister? He that doeth the will of my father. But it was his mother outside, and we can't blame her. But the brethren that were with her were those who did not believe in Jesus. They were members of his own household. And like he said, a prophet was without honor in his own country. Even he narrows it down to his own household.
That's
and
right.
We can see who they were in that household. Yes.
When after Jesus resurrected in that morning, when he spoke to Mary Magdalene, go to my brethren. He was after resurrected to go to my brethren that I was resurrected. In that context, he mentioned it.
Well, he did say that, exactly. I think the term there might be a little broader than just those two. But it would include them because when he went up there, we find something happened later on. In the book of Acts, when they were waiting for Pentecost, they were there. These two who didn't believe, they were there. And we think that what woke them up was when Jesus was raised from death. When Jesus was raised from death for those 40 days, these who had been sarcastic in his own household, they had abundant evidence that he was alive. And they knew he was crucified. They knew he was on that cross and died. And then when he appeared in Galilee to 500 people, do you think that he appeared to those 500 and these two who differed and didn't believe in him were not there, were not aware of it? If you were in that family and you heard that your brother Jesus, the Messiah, was risen from death, why, curiosity would demand that you look into that information. And certainly the mother would be involved up there and see. Who certainly believed, they would, and this we think shocked them out of their endurance, because when we find them in with the other apostles later on, the brethren are there. Why are they there? Waiting, see, showing that their faith now became established. Now notice the way Jesus answered that question, that dig. My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready. Now that took constraint. Notice that he's speaking in a very dignified way. He does not let that get rile him up. It reminds us of the way Moses, when he was down at the Red Sea, and the nation at that time criticized him when they saw Pharaoh's chariot there, and the way Moses behaved under that very, where they began to criticize him, he ignored the criticism. He felt it. Oh, he must have felt it keenly, but he ignored it, and he did what was best. That's a sermon in itself, which we haven't time to go into, but his behavior on that time, he was a true messenger of the Lord when he behaved that way. And so Jesus here stifles his own feeling in this matter on this occasion and makes this what would might be considered a rather bland statement, like brushing aside, my time is not yet come. Your time is already. And the world cannot hate you, but me it hateth, because I testifieth of it that the works thereof are evil. Go ye up unto the feast. Now, he's answering this question. He's not answering the question. In the sense, he admits that there's hatred against him. He admits that. That's why he didn't expose himself recklessly to start with in verse, what is it, 1 or 2? It mentioned because the Jews were planning to kill him. That's why he didn't go stay in Jewry, but went back to Galilee and ministered in Galilee. But he admits, but then he says that why they hate him is because he was forthright. Whenever he said things, so this, he didn't speak things to tickle the palate of his hearers. If one wants to be a king or a prince or a leader, this is usually the easiest way. You please your audience. If you please your audience and you make a big hit, well, then you're winning their support. You become popular. But he does the opposite. He speaks. And when he speaks, he antagonizes the majority because their works are evil. That's why.
Yeah. A good example of that is where Absalom would stay at the gate in order to win the affections away from his father, David. And he would be distant, wasn't it?
Yes.
When they would come to plead their cause, putting on all this here sweet
mannerism,
because his desire was to take the kingdom away from his father.
And he had the beautiful long hair. Oh boy, he was a real idol. I mean, like a movie idol. Said when, how long and beautiful. His character was very underhanded, very demeaning. Incidentally, that was the cause of his death. That very thing he honored was the thing that was a pitfall to him, and his hair got caught in the tree. And then was it Joab that went out and flew him? Because he was hanging helplessly, his hair entangled in the boughs of the low-hanging trees when he was riding under them. Go ye up unto this feast. I go not up yet unto this feast, for my time is not yet full come. He did not lie, but they could understand by what he said. They might have thought that he wasn't intending to go up yet. So the yet there might have had a different implication, but actually, he's just saying, I'm delaying going. I'm going, but not right now. But they would get that as this is an excuse. And they would go ahead in his absence. They'd go on. Yes.
I appreciate that. I was reading this morning and I wondered why he changed his mind.
So he's truthful in what he's going to do, but it could be misunderstood. And of course, if he went down with them, having done these works and so forth, and they would be very, it would enhance them. They would be happy because the popularity would rub off on them. Why, we are members of the family. You know, we are, and so it really would have an effect. They're not really thinking of Jesus' ministry and so forth, because it says there that they didn't believe in him. They did not believe in him. But they could believe in him as a hero, or in that sense, but not believe in him as the Messiah. Isn't that strange? It just shows you that if Jesus, let us say, we were back there, and he was a member of your own family, would you recognize him as the Messiah? That's a startling question. They would have to recognize the miracles he did. They would have to recognize that other people appreciate what they did. But to recognize him as the Messiah, it shows us that sometimes you could have the best personage in the world sitting next to you, the Messiah himself, and not know it. Isn't that a rather sad situation? And it may not be because you're an evil person. It's because you just don't doesn't gel right, and the fault really lays with you in that recognition, lack of recognition. Yes.
Or it could be one of the humble little flock, the humblest maybe, and it just doesn't seem to be very important. Your side, no particular outstanding culture or manners or whatever, and you kind of slice them in favor of some of the more outstanding characters.
Yep. There was that incident on the train that Pastor Russell writes about. There was this little thin man on the train that was going on to some convention or something with him, and they wondered about this, who is he, what is he, you know. And evidently he's got his dander up, because this man had given tremendous financial support. That's how much he believed in the Pastor Russell's ministry. He gave a very large donation, but they were thinking of him as, is he a brother or something like that? So, some people look at the exterior of that makes more impression. Pay attention to those who are. You cannot be a teacher and not speak. You see what I mean from that standpoint. But when you're not a teacher, that puts you in a sort of a humbler attitude, because then if you're not normally given to it, you cannot be really appreciated in some things that you might do, because man looketh on the outer appearance, but God looketh on the heart. So in this particular case here, there are those right in this household who did not appreciate it. Any other comments?
Frank, in the chapter before, I would have thought that they would have acknowledged that he was the Christ, as Peter said. Would you leave also? And he said, who would we go to? That you have the words of life, that you are the Son of the living God. He made that statement so that I would have thought, by making such a statement, that he would have believed that he was Christ, that he was the Messiah.
He did, though. He did. It's different, brother.
Yeah. But the two brethren we're talking about are not apostles.
Did he acknowledge them as his brethren also?
No, natural brothers. Stepbrothers.
Yeah.
But stepbrothers are right in the same house, same building, with the mother.
It's not the apostles that were going down to the geese that asked Jesus to go with them.
When he talked about his brethren, I, w- I, just,
Oh, assume that his brethren are his apostles, but because he considered them his brethren.
He talked to them, but only in a natural way. In a spiritual way, he made a very definite distinction. Who are my mother and brethren, so forth? He that doeth the will of my Father in heaven. Now, he could look on his mother in two ways, as a believer and as his mother. His mother probably did not get the depth of appreciation in its fullest sense until later. But the apostles, to a certain extent, also did not get the full depth until later. But they had a sufficiency of zeal to accompany him wherever he went. That cost a lot to them. They left their vocations to follow the Master, walk with him. Incidentally, with regard to his popularity earlier, he could separate himself from the crowd very well, the techniques that he could use, just like the technique when he went up to the mountain to pray, or telling me, I'll meet you at such and such a place. And he could absent himself and then meet them. And leaving Galilee, he could meet them in Nazareth on the way down, if he took the upper road down, and say, I'll see you in Nazareth, so forth, and make his journey that way. But here, this question is being raised on another occasion, when the Feast of the Tabernacles, not by the people, but by his brethren. Now, this separation is a little harder to make. It's pretty hard to separate yourself from your own family in going down, when you've been accustomed in times past, to go down with the family. Not merely during the three previous years, but when he was an adult. He went down yearly before his consecration at Jordan. Look, what all those years that before, when he was a youth of 12 years of age, and he became a man at 30 years of age and went to Jordan. So what did he do in those years? He went down to Jerusalem.
I realize what you're saying. It's just that I did not associate his natural brethren in the same context as the apostles that followed with him.
So that's why you have to, when we read statements, we have to stop and chew them over a bit. Because sometimes you'll use the expression brethren, meaning in the spiritual sense. And sometimes it's used in the natural sense. Well, you know that it can't be the brethren in the spiritual sense, because here it says they didn't believe in it. Where certainly the apostles believed in Jesus, and as has been pointed out by somebody, that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. To whom else shall we go? In the previous chapter. And that was the expression not merely of Peter. I'm sure it was the thinking of the others too, except Judas.
Two scriptures might help where it's clearly using the word brethren to mean natural brothers. Matthew 12:46 and Matthew 13:55.
So it would mean natural brethren in verse 5. Now, what did he mean that your time is already? My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready.
Your time is no limit. It doesn't matter. There's no difference.
You see, Jesus not only had to do what all Christians have to do, of which he sets the example, he had another restriction. He knew he had to die at a certain hour, on a certain day, on a certain year. We do not know when we die, what day, what year, what hour at all. And we have to go from day to day, not knowing. But he, knowing when he was to die, he had the problem of not injudiciously exposing himself recklessly before that time. So he had to observe certain criteria that others had not
We don't have that hanging over our head. We just have to be faithful day to day. He had to be faithful day to day, but he had to know that he should not expose himself in danger of death until the time came. And then he did exactly the opposite. Then the apostles, not the brethren, the apostles wanted to stop him. Oh, no, far be from thee. Oh, Lord. But because they knew he was, but he disregarded that. Get thee behind me, Satan. And then he knew that Satan was using the Apostle Peter to put that suggestion in his mind. If there was any least bit of cowardice in Jesus' character, the adversary knows just how to cater. You know, but he recognized it right away. So it shows that sometimes, even amongst the consecrated, that suggestions can be given that are not proper. And this is not really a reflection on them as an individual in their overall performance. It means that we have weaknesses and our thinking, our intellectual thinking is not 100%. We can be off on a point here and there because we are imperfect. But that does not mean that that imperfection stands over you as you're not going to graduate. Of that. In fact, a lot of our schooling is based upon our having made mistakes and seeing those mistakes and recognizing them and using them as stepping stones to further advancement of knowledge and of character development. Right in the back.
For the primary,
yes.
Wouldn't also be true of the feet members of the church that they should not run before the Lord or put themselves in any special danger if they feel they have work yet ahead, that to wait on the Lord, I mean, not to the same degree that Jesus knew it had an appointed time, but if you feel there, for instance, if we were to feel that in our lifetime that all things will be fulfilled, that we should wait on the Lord and not put ourselves in any particular danger for the wrong reasons.
Well, it's a hard
question.
Well, if you take it from that standpoint, but from another standpoint, you have to take now the Apostle Paul. He exposed himself to danger many times because he knew not any special hour. In other words, he did not foolishly do things, but I think it's with us. We don't know. The feet members are not like in this room here. How many people say? A dozen people, let's say. They're not in one location on one time because we are all separate beings. We live in different cities, different homes, different geographically. We're all the feet members of the body of Christ will be probably pretty well dispersed as individuals. But their judgment comes in a collective rather than in a geographic sense upon them at the opportune time at the end of the age. I think we have to use wisdom, yes, in one sense, but not. You have to be careful that we don't, that the flesh does not interfere with there might arise an occasion where it'd be very well that we speak out. And it might not be, we can see this is not the end of the age, but maybe as an individual, it may be your time to go, as an individual. I think we always have to be careful, because he says, in one sense, be ye wise as serpents, and harmless as doves. And he said this under a situation that we are before wolves. Cast not your pearl before swine, lest they devour you. So there is a certain discretion that should characterize our whole life. But to weigh the time, we'd have to be careful that we do not plot that time as being some other date, but try to be faithful day to day, and when occasion demands it. being forthright and courageous on that. And I think, too, on what will happen, too, with many, were that we may see we might fail on some little opportunities that are afforded us, and that will reveal a need of strengthening along a certain line for the real test that might come our way at a certain juncture of our life experience. Yes? Yes?
I was just going to tell a little story, maybe to explain, see if I understand what you're saying, the way I understand that we wouldn't jeopardize ourselves by taking our Bible into a bar where we knew the Hell's Angels hung out. But if we were somewhere with somebody and reading from the Bible with that person and the Hell's Angels came in, that we wouldn't stop reading. It has to be appropriate and with wisdom,
that's
what
right.
Saying.
Right. That's a good one.
Still showing
only practical illustration. Can we proceed just as, for my time is not yet full come. Now notice there, full come. Now before he would say, my time is not yet come. Or it would say, for his time was not yet come, when we read the other Gospels. But notice, he recognizes that it's nearing.
Verse 8, but not verse
6. Verse 6.
That's
yeah.
Right. So he's showing that he realizes his time is drawing near, but it's not full yet come. He still has 6 months to go, based on Daniel, the prophecy where Messiah would be, and that he would die April 3rd, AD 3rd, so he would know the day and the year. And then he would know the hour because the Passover lamb in the type was to be slain at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. So now he's putting all these together because he was a marvelous Bible student. And let alone, he knew a lot before he came here in the first place. And of what the Father's will was. So with his words, it shows you that you have to really, when Jesus speaks, my goodness, you have to sort of chew over everything he says carefully, because it's not a wasted word. Whatever he says, there's something there. Where we speak, maybe 10% of it might be valuable on some occasions, but with him, it was quite different. Now the ninth verse, when he had said these words unto them, he abode in Galilee. Now that would be a test. So they may raise this question, and then they leave. And they leave, and he stays behind. So appearances would seem to indicate evidences of weakness.
Cowardice.
That in spite of what he's saying, you see, that action, in spite of what he's saying, which is correct and true, and very sound wisdom, they would get a different import, and it's like we say with somebody that who was speaking that they might be coward, that is a lot of baloney. You know, we might say of certain other people, not appreciating their character. You say it's a bluff, all bluff. How courageous and so forth. So we can see the deeds, actions, and doctrines of others, but unless we take time to reflect, they will not make too much impression. So they leave, and he's behind. Have we time for any more discussion today? Let's read verse 10 through 13.
But when his brethren were gone up, then went he also up unto the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, where is he? And there was much murmuring among the people concerning him. For some said, he is a good man. Others said, nay, but he deceiveth the people. Howbeit, no man spake openly of him for fear of the Jews.
So he separates himself and goes down the, like we'd say, more or less incognito. And but you can see that when the family would come down, that others in Judea who might know the family, and they see them approaching, well, where's Jesus? He's behind. He didn't come with us. He said so and so and so and so. And so it also would mean, too, that those who would plot to apprehend Jesus, that they would be looking out for this family, because these feasts were family gatherings, more or less. All the males go up for the three feasts, and so we'd know that all the males in the family would be down at that feast, so you'd be looking for them. No, he's not there. Now, what happens? Notice the expression, the Jews. Why are they called the Jews? Notice that there is a territory involved. Those of Galilee are called
Galileans.
Therefore, those of Judea are Judeans, or Jews, using the short term. There are many expressions we use where we abbreviate the terminology, such as King Tut, because you don't want to say Tut Ankhamun or something like that, or you don't know the full name. Now notice they're down there, and he's a topic among the people. The people now, while they're in their moments of leisure, they talk about different things. Just like when you have a coffee or something and you have a break and there's some idle conversation. But in these conversations, the people are talking about this Jesus of Nazareth, of Galilee. And they're discussing amongst themselves, and we can see now that there's a division of sentiment among the people, some of which feel that Jesus is a what?
A good man.
Some said he had a devil.
Here it says he deceived the people. Yes, well, of those that talk, probably some spoke a little stronger, some less strong. But you could see, if you felt that he was a deceiver, you certainly would think that he was of the adversary in one capacity or not. Otherwise, you wouldn't call him a deceiver. And he is a good man. So this is the populace talk. And they would base that goodness upon
the
miracles that he had done,
the
healing of the sick, expending his energy and his sympathy. They could see that he really entered into the ills of other people. Not just wave a wand and you're all cured, but that there was some personality exchange, and they could see in that he had compassion. It says he looked on the multitudes with compassion. You wouldn't say that unless you could observe it in his countenance. There was something that, because you can't read the heart. So man looks on the countenance. And, but not as a prophet. They don't say here, well, he's a prophet. He may not be the Messiah, but he's a good man. But others, oh no, he's a deceiver. So this is really the thing. He's a deceiver. He's not a deceiver. That's what it amounts to. But nevertheless, this is talk, chit-chat, but more important than chit-chat, but from their standpoint of the populace, they're hearing these reports, and these are of Jewry. These are not of Galilee. It's showing that down in Judea, they're hearing about what's up in Galilee. They're hearing about these reports up there, and so it's this populace down in Judea that are talking back and forth. The Galileans wouldn't be chit-chat, because they'd see the miracles. They would see, or if they didn't see them, they'd certainly hear them, because if you feed 5,000 people, besides women and children, miraculously with bread, certainly if you had other family members who weren't with you, the family members would know. So there are a lot of people up there who would be more or less familiar with what's going on. But the ones down in Jerusalem now, the area, there's a discussion. But one thing, they don't want this to be overheard on the outside. This would be particularly true of the ones who would speak that he's a good man. Because if you say he's a deceiver, you wouldn't be as fearful as of being overheard, let's say, by the scribes and Pharisees. If you manifested your sympathy that you thought he was a deceiver, you didn't have to worry about your own neck so much, would you? It would be the ones who felt that they didn't fully understand him as the Messiah, but thought he was a good man. They'd want to keep that pretty quiet, because it was known down there that, what do they call that out? The mafia and all they have. What do they call that? The thing that,
contract.
A contract, that's it. That there was like a contract out. I'm speaking in rather vulgar language, but sometimes this is more mathematical. It's something practical, something real, not just a story we're reading. They knew that this was more than just they'd like to kill him. Oh, they wanted to kill him. They would like an opportunity. It was more realistic. And because sometimes people say, oh, I'd like to murder that fellow, but they don't do it. Why don't they do it? Because they're afraid they'd go to jail or the chair or whatever. That's why they don't do it. But they do express that they don't like a certain person. But this goes further. They really wanted to carry this nefarious scheme to its fruition. Now, we could take two verses only, and we'll close the study after we discuss it. 14 through 50.
Now, about the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught, and the Jews marveled, saying, how knoweth this man letters, having never learned?
Now, when you say now in the midst of the feast, when would that be?
Well, the feast was a week long, so perhaps three, 4 days into the feast.
All right. If the feast began on the 15th day of the seventh month, well, then it would mean the 17th or 18th day of that month. He gets up in the midst. Now, isn't that's rather dramatic. He's quieting himself, holding that, but now he did not want to disturb the beginning. And why?
He might be known at that time either. Maybe it was more, in the very beginning of the feast.
Why not the first day?
They were looking for him then.
All right, well, one reason might be along that line, but there'd be another reason too that would have. Maybe he did not want to destroy the harmony of the devout. who are coming to this feast, and they, you know, when you come to the feast, and it's the first day, there's a certain procedure that takes place. To get up and disturb that written procedure in the law, where it says you do so and so and so, rather than disturb that, he let this religious service start and proceed for a while. And then, judiciously, in the midst of the feast, get up at an opportune moment, but expose himself. Because this getting up, and now we notice when he does this, we almost have to consider this. Now, then it says, and taught, went up into the temple and taught. In the meantime, he probably was where during these days normally, because he could only be a certain amount of time in the temple. Mount of Olives, possibly with the home of Lazarus, or Simon, the home of Simon, another Simon, the leper, but in the vicinity. And then during the temple hours, during the daytime, he would then go down into the valley, up into the temple, and go enter it. And then on the side, teach, probably in what's called Solomon's portico at that time. Solomon's porch, some translation put it. The Jews marveled, saying, how knoweth this man letters, having never learned? What caused them? They're listening to him teach.
Acts says that he spoke that they were all in different languages. And that he spoke they were understood. They were all in different
languages. Well, that was true with regard to the apostles. That was a sign. And these different nationalities were there at that time.
We're all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, behold, are not all these which speak Galileans, and how we hear every man in our own tongue?
Well, that's true with regard to Pentecost. But that not, I don't think that he was speaking different languages. The rest of it, what you're saying, yes. But
it would have been his profound reasoning on the scriptures, wouldn't it? Yet he was never, he didn't sit at the feet of Gamaliel, he only didn't have the formal education.
Could it be free as many from Nazareth were there who knew of his own childhood and his bringing up that he was not a man scholarly, that is given the scholarly education. And they went every year to make these feasts, even as family, so they would have been familiar and would see him come with his family.
All right, there's several factors that enter in that. That's one factor, that's the other. The ones who could say, having never learned, that's the part you're treating now, could say so from a practical observation. That would be it would be mostly Galileans who would appreciate, because he lived in Nazareth of Galilee the greater part of his life. So to say, this man having never learned, they would know that he never went to, let us say, school there. And they knew that he was a carpenter, that he supported his family, Joseph probably having died. But that seems to be indirectly or insinuated by reading the Gospels in a overall sense, and thus supported his mother. That he was a carpenter, not one who was studying not studying for the ministry, not studying to be a rabbi. Right, that'd be how can this man teach this way? And we know that he never would. So it would be based on his language, his erudition, knowing the scriptures by heart. And they knew that he didn't go and learn this like we learned it by what they call rote. Well, that's the old-fashioned word, meaning you memorize the text like a parrot. They could tell by his recall and his expounding of scripture that he would know all these places, could quote it accurately. And they couldn't understand. This would be profound. How in the world can he understand this? And wonder about his access to this. Incidentally, Jesus had access to the scriptures, the Old Testament, for centuries before, when they were in process of development. So he could quote Isaiah and know Isaiah. Know Isaiah. Know Abraham. And know Noah and all these others. He would know them, having seen them, having heard them. So that when you have all this knowledge, and you may speak on a very simple subject, but that kind of has a little added zing or ring to the way you say things, that you know whereof you speak. So it's not only like speaking with authority. They could see there were nuances in his thing that they could marvel. How can this man? Goodness. Without the education of speaking this way, and we listen to these rabbis and all, why, they haven't got half on the ball, but this man has. We can't understand it. How can he do this? And then speaking in the Hebrew. And incidentally, he doesn't have to have the dialect of that. You see, when you're from different Brooklyn or from the West, or the drawl, you have the Western drawl, Brooklyn accent, or you might have a foreign accent. He could speak in like the pure Hebrew to them, which is like is not taught in the normal curriculum, because you don't need it. If you're a carpenter and all, you only need a vocabulary of say 600 words, and you'd pass as a normal, well-informed person. But when you come to scriptures and all, and to do the, so you could see that place yourself back there and listening to him give this teaching in the midst of this feast on this occasion, that they could marvel at him. And it would probably be mostly from those up in his area that would know him more intimately than the Jews did down in Jerusalem. Now, notice, when they're saying these things, he's talking. Now they're on the side. How can he say this? Well, he never went to school. And now he's talking, but he knows what they're doing. So that's another thing he took. So when he finishes his discourse and all, now he addresses this conversation on the side, which he knows he's aware of, miraculously aware. He can, just by a look and all, get the gist of what's going on. And now what does he say? Marvelous. My doctrine is not mine. Isn't that humble? He puts the Father first. Time after time after time. Honors God for it, not self. But he does not minimize self in the sense of his authority. No, he is the Messiah. He is a point. And he's not going to be a little humble servant and not say anything. And you go first. Let's hear what you have to say. No, he's the Lord. He's the Messiah. He's supposed to be the speaker and take a more aggressive role in his speaking, because he's been appointed. So he's loyal to that. But he prefaces so often his remarks by cognition of the Father, whether it's with regard to miracles or certain things, like Lazarus, raising Lazarus from the, he looks up into heaven, I thank thee, O Father. So, but they can see that he's giving credit to somebody else and not to himself. So this is interesting to see the behavior under these circumstances.
So yes. Again, we have two scriptures, 16 and 17, the indirection of the Trinity. John is powerful
yes.
for that.
Yes. And yet they use John, his epistles, to prove the Trinity, which are spurious passages. In part, the part that's spurious is the ones that they are the most pertinent parts of their argument, but do not have any foundation. My doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me. If any man will do his will, not my will, his will, he shall know the doctrine. Now, we had that in the previous chapter, the confidence Jesus has that all that are of the Father will hear the message of truth. That it isn't as though it's all hanging on your shoulder. If you don't, God's work cannot fail. And he used as a text earlier, they shall all be taught of God. So there's no anxiety like the Pope will give. Well, if we don't do this, what will the world come to? Look, the church is around ready to fall, collapse. We must do this, we must do that. Like they're straining to defend the impregnable fortress of Jehovah. That this doctrine, there are some that in Jesus' day did not accept Christ, but maybe a year or two later, 3 years later, 4 years later. But all that the Father had in mind that were to be called, Jesus had no anxiety along that line. He'd have responsibility to those who he sees already drawn. Of those whom thou hast given me, I have lost none save one. So those that he saw that were consecrated came to him, he was dedicated to them to do his utmost to defend them, to fortify them, that they might make their calling and election sure. But this anxiety is as to who's going to hear this doctrine. No, the Father will take care of that. If any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself. But this is marvelous because it not only shows the Father's what's the term they meant? Omnipotency, but he even gives credit to the individual, the devout soul, who is trying to serve God, who may not be in your midst. It may be someplace else. But there are these hungering, devout souls, hungering and thirsting after God, whom, if they are in the proper heart condition, the Father is going to call them. You don't have to worry about them, because this rapport between that devout soul and the Heavenly Father is going to be the contact, whether you are involved or not. Now he's talking about those in his presence. Now, here, those that are hearing him, they, if they're drawn to the Father, they could listen to Jesus, and no matter all the others may differ and disagree, they would eventually get the point. It also cast reflection on those who profess to be of God, but who may not know the doctrine. So it does hurt. See what I mean? It hurts those who are ostensibly following God. Take where he's talking in the temple. Don't you think there's some people in the temple who were scribes? Pharisees, or who were ones who went like they do today to Mass and so forth every day, get up early in the morning, go to church and so forth, and they hear, and yet I don't know I believe what he's saying, you know. And that would be like an affront to you, your relationship. I love the Father. I go, I do this, I do that, and so forth. Or you may be in an office in the church like the Pharisee. You're already a religious leader. So it would turn off not only the religious, the professed religious leaders, but the poor, humble souls who felt they were devout, but they were ceremoniously devout, going through rituals, that but their heart condition might not be satisfactory before God. So whatever Jesus did, it hurt some people, but other people, it grew. It might hurt a little while, but it would be like a magnet. The truth would draw them as a magnet to his teaching. And this confidence in the Father is reflected here as it was in the previous chapter. He that speaketh of himself seeketh his own glory, but he that seeketh his glory, that seeketh his glory, that's the Father's glory, that sent him, meaning Jesus, the same, that is that individual, is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Now, did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keepeth the law? Why go ye about to kill me? Well, first, the first part of that, of course, is he's pressing this deep. And yet none of you keepeth the law. My goodness. You can see that with all Jesus Christ-like remarks, that they're not always tickling men's ears. No, many people think when you're on a platform, you have to speak nice things, prophesy smooth things. Well, I think a true prophet does speak smooth things at times, like Isaiah, and a lot of prophecies of the future, very beautiful things. But to be a true prophet, you have to give the whole word, like Paul says, I have given you the whole counsel of God. So Jesus here is, when he says this, that none of you keepeth the law, you know, some could take that very personal, but actually, a person in the right heart condition say, well, that's right, we are all, nobody has lived by this law. He's not criticizing the law, he's criticizing the fact that nobody's getting, obeying that law perfectly. And then he turns to this, and you go about to kill me. Now this would be, I think, very jarring, because they say, about to kill him. I'm not even about to kill him, and so forth. I mean, this is the reaction that they would take, many of them. But some of them that are listening would be in that frame of mind. Because when you have a contract out on for a certain individual to be slain, there would be people in the know who would know about this and who would like to curry favor. If you snitch on somebody, maybe you get rewarded. You know, you get recognition. You go to them and say, he's over here. He's speaking over there, and he's speaking things against the church and against so-and-so. And they're carrying men's favor. So there would be some of those who would listen. So he's addressing them, not the mass. Because the mass we had already heard said, some of them said, he's a good man. And some were saying, no, he's a deceiver. So there's a mix. Well, and he's not saying that every individual of those that are hearing him have this motive in mind to kill him. Even those who are speaking in favor and those who are not speaking in favor, those that are not speaking in favor may not be carrying it to that extent that they want to kill him. But amongst that group, there are certain individuals who are in the know and who want to be in favor with the priesthood and are sympathetic to the priesthood for whatever motive. They are in that order, and they are the ones he is addressing. Why do ye want to kill me. It's that element he's talking about. But when you're in that multitude, I'm not qualified to do that, and that's the way they're answering. And their attitude is quite, but he's not really talking to every individual. Yes?
And this is especially pointed to in saying that none of the people, because that was one of their specific accusations against him, he was breaking the Sabbath, breaking the law.
And this would be the Pharisaical element that particularly thought they were doing. They really thought they were obeying all the particulars of the law. They were doing it ceremoniously, though, as well as certain individuals. So it, in speaking, you sometimes you can't speak to individual and say, brother so-and-so and so and sister so-and-so, or Mr. so-and-so, or Mrs. so-and-so. No, you're... it's like we say, there's a saying, if the shoe fits, wear it. You know, meaning that if the criticism is really something that it's something you have to have corrected, well, it's for you then. And it's for you, whichever ones that fit the circumstance. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keep the law? Why go ye about to kill me? And then the people who would not understand his technique would say, well, the man's crazy. That's far from my thinking. Even the ones who say he's a good man, that'd be completely foreign about him. No, he's addressing certain ones in that audience that he can't conveniently take them out and say, would you hear here and there, come over here, and I'd like to speak to you a moment. I can't do it that way.
Could it be, too, that knowing that this is what would happen when he was being led to the cross, that there would be the same good men maybe there already changed their mind? Let's get rid of it, you know. 1, 2, 3, they already have.
I would.
And he knew that, and that he's almost telling them in advance what they will do when the time.
Well, I think he would know that, and he would know about the fickleness, because it says on that occasion that he knew what was in man. So he knew the change, that the very ones who said, Hosanna to the Son of the Highest, could turn around and say, crucify him, because most people do things upon an emotional basis or through compulsion. But I think on this particular occasion, he has another strategy in mind, but he's suiting it to these certain ones. Now, this would have, I think, was a clever way. He knew his time was not yet come. That it said that earlier. And now he's down there in the wolf's den, as it were, right down there where there are these that are plotting him. But by saying it this way, addressing it to, the crowd doesn't know what he's saying, really. But if anybody who was plotting to kill Jesus then was starting to go, and they say, well, he's right. Well, we've got to watch out for this, their plan. So he's alerting them to what was the intention of some people, what they were intending to do, and he's nipping it in the bud. And he's protecting himself from unnecessary danger by the very technique he's using. I tell you, Jesus is profound. It's astounding, the knowledge of Jesus. What is so astounding is, it's one thing if you have and say, come back in an hour, and then you go in like a judge, go in the back room, and then you think this out quietly with no distraction, and you try it, and you're very learned on the law, but you still have to sort it out, and then you go out and make a decision. No, he does this in the tumult. Right in the midst of all this thing, with all these distractions and so forth, that he can, with this composure, this marvelous composure, that he can know what to say, how to say it, and do everything, and he can even get angry, but still in his anger, know how to say it, you know, exactly in the right way. This is what is astounding with regard to him. None spake, no man airspake as this man. But the crowd here wouldn't appreciate, but we can appreciate, see, because we're looking back on history, and we can see that this is in a way that they were not privileged back there to so do. I think we have to close the study because it's overlapping into a late hour. So we'll close with a